You are. From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Middle East continues to boil in this sixth day of Israel's tough campaign, and there's no end in sight. Today, hundreds of Israeli tanks rolled into three West Bank towns. 200 Palestinians remain holed up in Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity. Israeli forces clashed with Lebanon's Hezbollah guerrillas near the border, and Egypt, which has a peace treaty with Israel, cut back diplomatic ties with the Sharon administration. Serious analysts are now biting their nails as they watch, one by one, the countries of the Middle East become actively drawn into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's hardly a stable area in the first place, they worry, with Saddam, religious fundamentalism, disaffected publics, weak regimes, skilled terrorists, and the question of nukes. Could the Israeli-Palestinian conflict boil into a region-wide meltdown? Is the whole Arab world at risk, and with it, U.S. interests? This hour, an entire region poised on the verge. First, a report from Iraq. The Christian Science Monitor reports today a claim that Saddam Hussein planned 9 terrorist attacks against the United States starting last year. Correspondent Scott Peterson uncovered the story. I spoke with him earlier as he had just left Iraq. I asked him to give us the nub of his report.
Back in the year 2000, there was an Iranian operative who was working for the Iraqis who was basically told about a plan by members of Saddam Hussein's inner circle to blow up American warships in the Persian Gulf. He was an Iranian passport holder, and the plan called for his purchasing a ship, flying the Iranian flag on it, packing that ship with 500 kilograms of explosives, and then the Iraqis would supply a suicide crew that would basically take the ship to its target and blow it up. In fact, it was a scenario, but on a larger scale, from what we saw just a few months later in October 2000 when the coal was blown up in Yemen.
Scott, who is the man who's told you this story? Where did he tell you, and in what circumstances?
This is a man who, he's got an Iranian passport, but he's really a smuggler by trade. And he's someone who began smuggling years ago. He's from an area of southern Iran where smuggling is very common. It's called Ahvaz. And he was doing a lot of transporting of weapons and other things from Iraq across Iran to Afghanistan. He was asked to set up smuggling routes and really was working as that kind of conduit. Now, over time, as he began to do increasingly complex operations, he apparently also caught the attention of some ranking people in Iraq. And one day in February 2000, he was called to a meeting in Iraq in Saddam Hussein's hometown, near Tikrit, where he was met two senior members of the regime, and basically they outlined in broad detail 9 operations. They said that they had 9 operations that they wanted him to carry out, that they had earmarked $16 million for these operations, and that the first one was going to be this effort to blow up an American ship. And as he explained it to me, this was going to be a long-term plan. It was one that he expected was going to be carried out or was meant to be carried out in early 2001. The problem was for him and for the Iraqis was that he had 1 or 2 assignments to take care of first, and in the course of those assignments, he was picked up in northern Iraq by the Kurdish group with whom I was traveling, and they are the ones who now have this smuggler in custody, and he was telling me this story from his detention facility.
So this smuggler, Mohammed Mansour Shahab, is in custody of Kurdish opponents of Saddam Hussein. Kurdish opponents who receive support from the United States?
Well, they don't really receive very much support from the United States, except that the area where they control now is protected by U.S. and British aircraft. Basically, this is a safe haven that was set up at the end of the Gulf War. You'll remember that there was a Kurdish uprising back then in 1991. The Kurds moved south, and then when it became clear that Saddam Hussein was turning the tables and counterattacking, we had 1.5 million Kurds cross the border into Turkey and into Iran. So in there are 2 Kurdish factions. They control the territory without very much meddling from Saddam Hussein. And this particular smuggler, the reason why he came into their hands was he had carried out an operation to deliver some refrigerator motors with some specifics and special substances attached to them to the Taliban, to al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And on his way back to get to Iraq, he was unable to cross the normal border, the normal southern border, because there were military exercises going on that Iran was conducting at the time. And so he decided to go up north, crossing into Kurdistan, which, as I said, is not controlled by Saddam Hussein, and in fact was almost successful. He got to the last checkpoint and basically was caught out because of his accent. They heard his accent, could tell he wasn't Kurdish, started to question him, and then they also found on him at that time a roll of film. And when they processed this film, they found that this 29-year-old man had actually killed at least one man, because the pictures depict him killing a man with a knife and then holding up his ear that he's severed off. No one knows, of course, who the dead man was, but there is speculation among Kurdish circles that this must have been some kind of a high-level hit.
So you have a story from a smuggler, an Iranian smuggler in the custody of Kurdish opponents of Saddam Hussein, linking Iraq to terrorist activity or intended terrorist activity against the United States. I have to ask you, since Washington has been so keen to establish exactly this kind of link, how great is the credibility of this story, or could this be part of a disinformation campaign intended to build a case for U.S. attacks against Iraq?
I certainly don't think it's part of an American disinformation campaign. There are two reasons in my mind why there is sufficient credibility here to at least listen to this story. One is that the Kurdish people who were questioning him, the security officials who were interrogating him, what helped to convince them that he was legitimate, at least in some elements of his story, was that the details that he gave of the members of Saddam's inner circle that he says he met, that he claims he met, matched perfectly with independent corroboration and cross-examination that they say that they received from another Iraqi intelligence official. One other aspect to lend to the credibility, and that is that I myself have traveled down into that area of southern Iraq, exactly where this operation was to have been carried out. And the descriptions of where the date palm farms, the descriptions of how close this operation would have been to the city of Fao and that sort of thing all match perfectly with what it actually looks like.
Scott Peterson is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. The escalating violence on the West Bank has the entire Middle East poised on a knife edge. Huge crowds are in the Arab streets demanding that nervous regimes do something to help the Palestinians. The nightmare scenario, a Middle East meltdown into region-wide war. In this hour, the United States, the Arab world, and the rippling impact of Israel's tough stand. Is the Arab world at risk of a meltdown? Will the United States be pulled into the fray? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined now by Edward Luttwak. He's a senior fellow for preventative diplomacy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington and has served as consultant to the U.S. Defense Department, National Security Council, and State Department. Good evening and welcome, Edward Luttwak.
Good evening.
Edward Luttwak, this region has always been seen as a powder keg. You've written compellingly that the powder keg is at greater risk of blowing up right now than it has been in a long time.
Well, actually, I was rather describing how a blow-up might take place if it does go over the brink. I actually have no real strong sense of whether it will go over the brink or not. So the piece you quote was just an analysis of how it would unfold,
Right. We can all feel the tension rising, and while no one is saying that this will happen, you've written a chilling scenario of how this could unfold in directions that would take the conflict much wider. Could you describe the series of dominoes that you've theorized could lead to a region-wide war?
Well, the Egyptian government is in a very difficult position because for a long time, particularly the last year and a half, more especially in the last few weeks, they have been stressing again and again. They've been showing endless television footage on the government television about the most brutal scenes they could find
of Palestinians suffering
and so on and so forth. They don't show scenes of bombs blowing up and killing Israelis, but they do show again and again the scenes of Palestinian brutal scenes of the occupation. And the message they've been pushing is that the Palestinian question is the most important question for Egyptians, not their own government, the corruption of their own government, the mismanagement, the inefficiency,
the terrible economy,
the terrible economic conditions, and economic decline, but rather this. Point one. Point two, since the Egyptians spend a lot of money on the military forces.
Much of it provided by the United States.
Well, the United States provides, certainly, pays for the equipment,
mm-hmm.
for the tanks. They have these very modern M1 tanks and other things from the United States. The while on the one hand stressing how important the Palestinian issue is, and indeed it's all important,
mm-hmm.
at the same time they justify the vast military expenditure, their own, as well as what they spend from USAID, by stressing how powerful Egyptian forces are, how glorious and powerful and all, you know, mm-hmm. omnipotent, and they can mm-hmm. do anything and so on. So now Mubarak, whose media have been essentially running these two twin campaigns,
mm-hmm.
it may now be hoisted on his own petard. He might be captured, may become prisoner of his own propaganda, if we are so powerful, and if, as you say, the Palestinians are in such tragic conditions.
Mm.
Why aren't we using Egyptian forces to help them?
So this could lead to a public demand that something be done.
Already, the public demand is already with us. This
mm-hmm.
part of the scenario is already in place.
Mm-hmm.
So if the pressure becomes high enough, the Egyptians might then violate the terms of the peace treaty and move their forces, or part of the forces, let's say several armored divisions,
mm-hmm.
into the Sinai in order to compel the Israelis to counter-mobilize and guard their frontier.
You're not saying actually invade Israel, but
advance
the tanks into the Sinai.
Into the Sinai and
mm-hmm.
move up to the Israeli border.
Mm-hmm.
Not invade, not shoot, not do anything, but simply mobilize against the Israeli border
mm-hmm.
in order to compel the Israelis to counter-mobilize and presumably possibly call off their offensive in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the Israelis, if faced with these Egyptian forces, the peace treaty is dead. This is, of course, a huge step. Violating a treaty would mean the loss of USAID.
Mm-hmm.
It would be catastrophic and so on. Thousand reasons not to do it, but if they do it, then the Israelis counter mobilize. And since the Israeli army is not an active duty professional army, but is largely 70-80% a reserve force,
right.
they have to mobilize the civilian population to man these forces.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the next thing that happens is that the Syrians, there's intense political competition between Syria and Egypt. The Syrians, seeing the Egyptians doing all this, the Syrians would then mobilize as well. And there is no peace treaty there preventing that, and they would simply move the forces up to the Golan Heights frontier.
As a point of pride, as to not be shown up by the Egyptians.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to realize that this is crucial. I mean, Mubarak himself would not go to the Beirut summit, the Arab summit, because of the fact that Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia was going to have the lead role.
Lots of rivalry here.
Yeah, I mean, when Mubarak of Egypt goes to an Arab summit, he has to be the top number one.
And at this point in the scenario, we now have two armies mobilized.
That's correct. At that point, the largely the sort of majority Palestinian population in Jordan agitates and says, what? The Syrians are doing it, the Egyptians are doing it, we have to do it too. At that point, the Jordanian government is much, you know, very greatly attached to his peace treaty. They wouldn't want to do it, doesn't mm-hmm. want to do it, etc., etc. But in that case, you know, they might be compelled. And whereupon you have a fully mobilized Israeli, not only army, but society, the whole country stands still. Everybody's in the armed forces.
And they can't hold that position for long.
They cannot hold it for long.
Which requires what?
It shuts down the economy and the whole country. So unless at that point there is some kind of very quick resolution, let's say the Israelis call off the offensive, they don't, or whatever it's taken that they have, at that point, everybody goes home, nothing happens. But if they don't go home, after a certain amount of time, the Israelis cannot demobilize and take their army home while they have Arab armies right up against their frontier.
So they must act.
And at that point, they would have to attack in order to disperse them, drive them back, that kind of stuff.
Edward Luttfak, let's hold it right there. We've got to take a brief break. We're looking at a nightmare scenario that could spin out of the current conflict on the West Bank in Israel. And asking, how high do you see the stakes rising in the Middle East? How near the tripwire of full Mideast war have we come? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the possibility, the risk of a meltdown into region-wide war in the Middle East, spinning out of the conflict going on right now in the West Bank. And the question is, how high do you see the stakes rising in the Middle East? Could Arab rage force Arab tanks into action? And if it does, how will Israel respond? How would the United States respond? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined this hour by Edward Luttwak. He's Senior Fellow in Preventive Diplomacy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And right now by Stephen Van Evra. He's Political Science Professor at MIT and a specialist in Middle East defense policy. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Van Evra.
Good evening.
You've heard the scenario, and granted it is at this point only by Edward Luttwak's own concession, a scenario that's been described here. Nobody wants this to happen, but yet we all know that tensions have risen very dramatically in Arab nations, that many regimes in these nations are nervous about their own stability. How close to this kind of tripwire do you feel the region might be at this point?
Well, I don't think we're close to it, but I think Ed Luttwak's scenario is plausible, and it's one way that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict could wind up working its way through Arab politics. There's no question that this conflict is radicalizing the Arab street throughout the Arab world. I think there's several scenarios that are plausible for how this radicalization could work its way through the system. All of them scary. This is one of them. I think that his exact scenario, I find not very likely, because I think the Mubarak regime is quite judicious and cautious and unlikely to be as rash as Nasser was in 67.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we're going to have an interstate war flowing out of this, it's more likely to come from mistakes made by Syria. The Syrian regime is young, green, and I think not very smart. And I think that it's plausible that Bashar Assad could overreach in some way, specifically by assisting or helping Hezbollah to attack northern Israel.
And, of course, that front has already been opened up today with selling there.
Yes, it was, very ominously. Mm. So I think there's more of a risk that we could see some kind of interstate conflict flowing out of Lebanon and Israel going against Syria.
Edward Luttwak, you've written exactly this, that this is the dynamic of the 67 war, that nobody exactly planned to go to war. There were shows of force that then spun into war. In the scenario that you published today, you describe Egypt as the starting point. Can you imagine Syria as a starting point?
Well, yeah, I mean, what Professor Manevra said is completely correct.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the regime of Mubarak is a judicious and careful regime and so on and so forth. Point one. The Syrian thing is more plausible for the reasons he said, but as against that, the Syrians have not, in fact, Syrian propaganda to their population has not been that the Syrian armed forces are all powerful.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot take that position because, unlike Egypt, they have not had back their losses of 67. They haven't regained the Golan Heights. So if they were taking the line that they're all powerful, they would be vulnerable, so they'll undo it. But I accept that, Mubarak is judicious. And in addition, it would be such a mechanical replay of 1967,
mm-hmm.
which everybody remembers very well. I mean, in Arab political discussions, Arab political discourse, people, you can cite episodes of the 7th century, and they resonate. So you can be sure that people remember 67.
40 years back is easy to remember.
Yeah, very easy to remember. There was a complete disaster and so on. And they have a shrewd sense that the Israelis have become actually much more powerful than they were. In 67, they were devastating. They would be even more.
We'll speak
These
to that for us.
But unfortunately, there is a central fact in human life,
mm-hmm.
and that is that while madness is rare among people, it is quite common among entire nations. Entire nations going crazy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And here it's a very peculiar modern kind of craziness because it's, of course, television-driven. In the last few weeks, several hundred people have been killed in Algeria, many more than in Palestine. But they, you don't see them on television.
They're not on Al Jazeera.
It's just there's nothing on Al Jazeera. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There's only that. There's no other conflict. There's no other thing. And so madness, as I say, is a rarity. I know very few mad people, but nations become mad, and so. I have no knowledge, no sense, no certainty that anything like this is going to happen. My piece was only literally a scenario of saying, if it starts rolling, this is how it might roll. And I say the reason I have Egypt starting it, in spite of the judiciousness of the government, is because the Egyptians, the Mubarak regime's military propaganda has been, we spend all this money because it makes us so powerful, so powerful, and so on. And that, you know,
they're in their own trap in a way.
How come you don't do anything
about
it?
Why don't you use it? Edward Luttwak, just play the scenario out for us. If this, whatever the starting point should happen, and everybody's on tenterhooks in the region now, if it should come to this, how do you see the outcome and how do you see the consequences?
Well, about the military outcome, I think it's generally understood that the Israeli Air Force is the only air force in the world at this moment that has, on a smaller scale, the U.S.-type capability of routine precision. In other words, surveillance of the battlefield, target identification, and routinely being able to, when you launch a weapon, you hit the target 90% of the time, 70% of the time, something like that, not the 1 or 2% of the time of regular bombardment.
So you think in spite of the thousands of Arab tanks, the Israelis would do just fine?
Nothing is just fine. First of from the United States point of view, a mobilization, even before anybody shoots, would already be a catastrophic development, and the U.S. would, you know, be all out to intervene diplomatically and do everything necessary to stop it. It would be a catastrophe. But if you, the scenario were unaccountably reached its conclusion, the point where people shoot, then the general opinion is that the Israeli army outnumbered will nevertheless the ground forces will be highly effective because of the training and the skill that they have and so on, and reasonable equipment. And the Air Force, on the other hand, will be wholly superior in the sense that they will be able to operate combat targets one after the other, and if Arab Air Forces intervene, they will get shot down wholesale. And I offered in my piece a kind of 30-1 type ratio, and that's not supported historically. Historically, would that go higher than 30-1? So everything would go very well militarily, but it would still be a catastrophe because of a lot of people would get killed, and absolutely nothing would be achieved except to have fought a useless war over things that have already been settled. Because in reality, what remains unsettled is the Israeli-Palestinian relationship, not the Israeli-Egyptian or Israeli-Jordanian or even Israeli-Syrian.
And you say the Arab world would be further radicalized.
Well, listen, further radicalized. From my view of thinking, the Arab world was radicalized in 1922. We have to remember that September 11 was being planned out of the Arab world, out of Saudi Arabia, indirectly, directly, was being planned at the time when everything seemingly was going swimmingly, and everything was absolutely wonderful, and couldn't be better. And we're going to put Camp David, and we're going to have peace and everything else.
And
so
they were
sufficiently radicalized to plan, September 11 at the time.
Edward Luttwak, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I know we have to let you go, but thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Good night. Edward Luttwak is Senior Fellow in Preventive Diplomacy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the potential for a Middle East meltdown spinning out of what's going on in Israel. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How do you think the United States, how do you think Israel is assessing the risk? We're joined by Stephen Van Evra and now by Andrew Hess. He's professor of diplomacy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's director of the program for Southwest Asia and Islamic Civilization. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Hess.
Good evening.
We've been talking about Edward Luttwak's nightmare scenario of the conflict in Israel and the West Bank spinning into a larger conflict. He sees the tripwire lying in fragile regimes that would be driven to act by angry publics, angry Arab populations, just outraged over what's going on in the West Bank. How would you assess the risk of one of these Arab governments being pushed over that line into military action in support of the Palestinians?
Well, I suppose it's possible, but I think that long before that might happen, the United States would take a step in the direction of separating the two sides to this conflict. I think it would be out of one's mind to let it run in a military direction of large scale. And I'm sure that all of the intelligence community in the United States that has responsibilities for the Middle Eastern arena has their eyes on what might be the tripwires for some large-scale regional conflict.
But take us into some of these capitals. Ed Luttwak started with Cairo, and he said, look, there's already been large public demonstrations in the streets. Yes, we take Stephen Van Everest's point that Mubarak is judicious, but he's also vulnerable to public opinion at some point. Mm-hmm. What capitals do you see most vulnerable to anger in the streets?
Well, I think Jordan has got the biggest problem right now because it has a Palestinian population or a population that's connected with Palestine or the Palestinian cause. It's over 50% of their population, and they have a suffering economy. They're right next door to all of the violence, and they have a regime that really is not what one would call popular in the sense of being elected by the majority of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And representative of the interests of the majority of the population. So if things tend to pyramid, I think that that would be the first country to have problems. But then there's Lebanon.
Where there's already problems. Stephen Van Evra, of course, the Israelis know very well that at some point this possibility is out there. How do you think Israel is assessing the risk of a wider war?
I think Sharon is a guy who believes that in the end, if you have a big success of force majeure, you can quiet things down. And his record shows that he thinks in those terms.
Do you mean a force majeure in the West Bank or in a larger conflict?
Yes, I think he thinks he can win a big victory in the West Bank, quiet down the terror, and then the game is over.
Mm-hmm.
It's a parallel to what he thought he could do in 82 when he thought he could move into Lebanon, smash the Palestinian proto-state, create a Christian regime in Lebanon that would favor Israel.
How confident are you in that analysis?
I think he's wrong. I think that if he does win in the West Bank, which I think he's going to do, I'm more optimistic about Israeli success in this operation than most
mm-hmm.
people are. But I think in the end, it will be bad for Israel and bad for the U.S. It will lead to radicalization in the Arab world. There's another thing that we should talk about, which is it will lead to less Arab cooperation in our conflict with al-Qaeda. I'm particularly worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
We need the help of Arab countries, especially their intelligence services, running down al-Qaeda. This al-Qaeda threat we face is extremely serious and very grave. Al-Qaeda is out there tonight trying to bring weapons of mass destruction to the United States.
And you're saying this conflict may win them more safe harbors in the Middle East?
Yes, exactly. Jordan, for example, Professor Hess was just saying there's threat to the Jordan regime. Well, Jordanian intelligence is very good against al-Qaeda and very helpful to us. If we lost Jordan, it would be a tremendous blow to us.
Let's turn to our phones. A lot of people want to join the conversation. Alan is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hello, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Primarily, I wanted to address Mr. Luttwak and just state that I think his analysis is off. I don't see the...
That it won't happen, or that if it did happen, it wouldn't happen that way?
No, it wouldn't happen that way. I think Mubarak is smarter than that. You were using the word judicious. I think he's done some foolish things in the past, used some poor judgment on a number of things, but he's not stupid.
So if it unraveled, how do you think it would unravel, Alan?
I think much more likely is the possibility of Iraq being the odd card in this thing. And coming from Iraq, that if they see this thing heating up enough, you've got somebody there who's really a psychopath. I think there's more of a likelihood also of the young Assad overplaying his hand because he thinks he's got a lot to prove.
Mm-hmm. So there's a wild card that we know well. Alan, thanks for that for bringing that up. Andrew Hess, Ed Luttwak actually wrote about Iraq as well. He said he could imagine a scenario where Iraqi troops pushed right through Jordan if Jordan didn't move. Can you imagine that happening?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that Saddam Hussein right now is taking advantage of the lack of popularity for Israel and for the United States to advance its legitimacy in order to prevent some kind of an assault by the United States or an attempt to dethrone him. And I think he's doing fairly well. So the whole thing is working against the American position as far as the Iraqi regime is concerned. The longer this goes, the more Arabs will rally around Arabs, and the less more conservative regimes in the region will want to have something done to a person that they don't like themselves.
Mm-hmm. Fazal is on the line. Welcome, Fazal. You're on the air. Hello, Fazal.
Yeah. My question is, U.S., what moral authority United States will have to step in if one of the Middle East countries like Egypt or Syria or somebody just, you know, does something nonsense, you know, going against Israel? What moral authority United States will have then, because now just sitting and watching Israel do these massacres? Why can't they step in now and stop it? I wait for United States to step in when these other rogue nations will.
Well, we've got the question. Let me put it to Stephen Van Evra. How about the U.S. position here? Does it have the moral authority to be an arbiter? You're saying, and Andrew Hess is saying, that the U.S. won't let it get to this point in the first place, but the U.S. has been leaning back so far from this. And if push comes to shove, what is the U.S. position in terms of moral authority now in the region?
Well, I think we've gotten ourselves in some trouble by allowing a perception to grow in the Arab world that we're one-sidedly in favor of not Israel, but Sharon and his policies. We've raised no objection to the aspects of Sharon's policies that one might object to. Specifically, Sharon has a very ungiving and, I think, totally impractical negotiating stance vis-a-vis peace. He's willing to offer the Palestinians only, he said he's willing to offer only 42% of the West Bank in exchange for peace. This is a total non-starter, and the Bush administration haven't jawboned with him on it. They haven't objected to it. They also haven't objected to the continuation of Israeli settlements under Sharon. He's expanded settlements over the time he's been in office. This is a very incendiary thing to do.
And so now it's playing out in real time. Where does that leave the U.S. hand? Is it strong enough to staunch a spread of this if that appears to be beginning?
Well, I think Professor Hess is right. If we actually saw Egyptian forces moving toward the Sinai, we could act to stop it. We have big and powerful forces of our own. We remember 67, and that war broke out in part because Lyndon Johnson decided not to intervene to free up the Straits of Tehran when the Egyptians shut them. And we're not going to make that mistake again. I think Professor Hess is right. But I think the caller is correct that we've put ourselves in a tough position. We aren't going to be seen as a legitimate actor in the Middle East.
I think it's even worse than that.
Andrew Hess.
I think it's even worse than that because the latest surveys, Gallup survey in the Middle East about the attitudes of most Muslims and Arabs and others about the position of American foreign policy in the region shows that they're hugely angry over the American position. And then what's happened in the Arab-Israeli conflict has just made it worse. So we will have to do something to stop the conflict from ballooning. And we're going to have to really get at the business of trying to restore our position in the Middle East as a whole.
Whether it's military or diplomatic in particular, you're saying?
Yes.
We're talking tonight about the potential for a wider meltdown in the Middle East. We started with Edward Luttwak talking about a military meltdown, and that sits out there as a possibility. What we're hearing from Stephen Van Evra and Andrew Hess is that a diplomatic meltdown of sorts is already underway with the United States losing support across the Arab world. What do you think? Could crisis in the West Bank ignite an entire region? Are Arab governments strong enough to resist public calls for action against Israel? And how does all of this devolve for the United States? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the potential for a meltdown in the Middle East tonight, for a full blow-up scenario spinning out of Israel's tough action in the West Bank. What do you think? How high do you see the stakes rising in the Middle East? Might Arab rage force Arab tanks into action? And if it does, how will Israel respond? How will the United States respond? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Andrew Hess, professor of diplomacy at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and by Stephen Van Evra, political science professor at MIT, and now by Paul. Paul, welcome. You're on the air. Hello, Paul. Are you there?
From which town?
We'll take you, Paul. You're on.
Okay, it's me then. Okay, as quick as I can. There's got to be frequent and unambiguous diplomacy as soon as possible because in this situation, you know, you've got Pakistan, Iran, and Iraq have missiles. One of those three, at least one of those three, has nuclear weapons. We don't know what Israel has. But the thing is, if this wider conflict got going in the region, the U.S., it seems, would get drawn in. Those three countries also, I would think. Now, Russia, I think, has been trying to form relations, better relations with the Arabs. Could they get drawn in? I don't know. World War One got started because two small countries fought and their allies got drawn in.
Small countries can lead to big wars. We know that from history. Paul, thanks for your call. Stephen Van Ever, I want to go back to this point of just how possible, how near or far, I guess how confident are you that the United States has a strong enough diplomatic leverage that it can be certain that it can keep the brakes on this thing spiraling?
Well, I think we have the power. The question is, do we have the will, and will we be quick enough to act if forces start to move following the Ludwig scenario? And I agree with Professor Hess. I think we will. It's these other two scenarios that are worrying me more. One is that we'll simply lose Arab cooperation against al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
The war against al-Qaeda is not going well, and we desperately need to roll this organization up. And to do that, we need lots of intelligence help. That's the main thing we need, and we need it from the countries who know the region. We ourselves have been caught flat-footed here with very few assets, intelligence assets, as they call it. We didn't keep the CIA really current on its Mideast capabilities in the last decade.
So you're saying never mind a region-wide war, there's a global war on terrorism, and what's going on may hurt American efforts to win it.
Absolutely. That's one thing that's worrying me a lot. The second question that's worrying me is, even if we don't have some region-wide Arab-Israeli conflict stemming from the current West Bank conflict, I think that if Sharon does crush the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank and Gaza today, and I think he will, I think that there's going to be reverberations that people better worry about. The Palestinians are going to interpret this to be the crushing of the national dream of the Palestinian nation. And the question then is, then what? This is a question everyone should be asking.
And what's the answer to that question?
Well, I'm afraid that we're going to see nihilistic terror start emerging from the Palestinians, that the whole definition of the situation will change, including weapons of mass destruction terror. Hmm. The idea that Palestinians are going to continue to sort of wage a limited conflict, they view this pragmatically. Even the rejectionist Palestinians today are saying, listen, Israel's a place we want to live in, and the idea of putting a dirty bomb in Tel Aviv is unthinkable. Mm-hmm. The idea of scattering, anthrax in Tel Aviv.
But we've already seen personal nihilistic terrorism. You're saying it could be on a larger scale.
Yes.
It could touch the United States.
And Israel.
Mm-hmm. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I think it's me.
Yes, David, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just thinking that by the U.S. seeming to abandon its role of honest broker in the region, that we're playing right into the hands of Osama bin Laden's goal, I think, of trying to exacerbate or get Arab nations to create,
You think we're playing right to his tune to polarize the world into
exactly.
The sort of Christendom and Islam, or however you want to describe it?
Exactly.
David, thanks for calling. Andrew Hess, let me put that to you.
Yeah.
And let me put it in this way, I guess. You've heard Stephen Van Evere's fear. At the same time, we know that there are very strong conservatives in the Bush administration who do not shrink from the notion of serious military conflict in the Middle East. Regime change is a popular phrase in Washington. Is it possible that in some margin of the world we're looking at, there are forces in the United States that want this thing to expand, that want some kind of chaos that will open an opportunity for American forces to go in and make changes they'd like to see made?
Oh, I don't think so. There are a lot of intelligent people in Washington, D.C.
But a lot of them are talking on this show about regime change and making
right.
No bones about it and looking, obviously, for a way to get it done.
Right. Well, I think that in some ways there is a very good reason to have people like Saddam Hussein disappear from the stage. The question is how to do it without injuring the long-run interests of the United States and our allies in the region. And that certainly has been raised to a very high level by this conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis now, because what it's making happen is for most of the Arabs of the region to see the war against terrorism as being a war against the Palestinians and against Islam. And that means that we'll never win the war against terrorism in this area of the world. And there are other reasons that haven't been mentioned for the serious nature of this, which is that this is an area of the world with a population that has an average age of about 15.
Mm-hmm.
And that population is now being subjected to bombarding images of Palestinians, Arabs being shot at or imprisoned in the West Bank. that cannot but have a widespread impact that will be very difficult to remove, especially if we concentrate our attentions only on the elite political issues.
Both you and Stephen Van Evra are suggesting that everything that's going on is going to make the war on terror a much more difficult war to win.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. There was a lot of protest from all Arab capitals when it appeared that Yasser Arafat's life may have been in danger. The later analysis that we've read on that is that Arab regimes, it wasn't just they were standing up for Yasser Arafat, but they were panicked that if he died, their own populations would explode. They would not be able to control it. Do you agree with that interpretation, Andrew Hess?
Well, I think that it varies across the face of the Arab world from regimes that have a very difficult internal situation like that in Lebanon to those that are authoritarian and would use force immediately to squash any kind of a challenge. Yes, the governments in this region of the world are ones that are not elected democratically. They don't have a lot of popular support. They have economies that are in trouble. And it's very easy for something like this to become a big encourager of regime opposition, and that is what they're afraid of, yes.
And Stephen Van Evra, I guess what's coming out of this conversation tonight is not so much the immediate fear of a spreading conventional war, but the silent blossoming of a deeper, more difficult war on terror as a result of what's gone on the last week.
Yes, exactly right. I think one analogy people should have in mind is the aftershocks of the 1956 Middle East War. Mm-hmm. Israel won a crushing victory over Egypt along with the British and French who helped along, and it all looked great. But it had huge reverberations in the Arab world. It triggered a rise of pan-Arabism, which led Egypt and Syria to form a union for a time. It led to Arab radicalism, which overthrew the regime in Iraq. There was a revolution there. The Hashemite king was killed, a new regime, more radical one, was put in power. The regime in Jordan was almost overthrown. There was a civil war in Lebanon that stemmed from radicals arising there. And there was a general turn toward a more belligerent approach to Israel among the Arab states. The Arab states were cowed by their defeat, and they were careful, more careful after 56 about provoking Israel, but they also were seething, and underneath there was much more rhetoric coming out of Arab beliefs mm-hmm. about how Israel should be destroyed.
And we can feel that tonight. Stephen Van Evra, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
And Andrew Hess, thank you so much for coming on.
Yes.
You can check out the latest news from around the world on our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a Bosnian-born composer reflects on the siege of Sarajevo. Was considered one of the most prominent young composers in the former Yugoslavia. But after organizing one of the first demonstrations against Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic, he soon found himself a marked man and left his homeland for America. 10 years later, Vuk Kalenovic has established himself in American classical music. Critics have called him one of the most important composers working today. 10 years after the siege of Sarajevo and the beginnings of the wars in former Yugoslavia, Kalenovic talked with On Point about that historic conflict and his work.
I was a professor at Belgrade Conservatory of Music. I was the most performed composer in Yugoslavia, abroad and in the country. It is very strange now to say it when I am in some kind of exile now here, when many of these things are not happening to me. It lasted somehow until the beginning of the war in Yugoslavia, in former Yugoslavia. Somehow I felt some kind of obligation to make some kind of protest or to do something against it. And I got the idea to make one very sarcastic act, to call people to come and to kneel and to beg Milosevic in the front of his office in the center of the city of Belgrade to ask him to resign. It was one symbolic act and at least something that can show that there is some other view, some other mind, some other people, and that they don't want to fight. They can accept a multinational country and so forth. It is very typical thunder opposition, opposition of nationalists and patriots. You know, when you feel that patriotism grows, you have to think about that, what it means. Everything starts like that. That's how Nazi movement started. Patriots, they were attacking me. They demolished my car in my garage. They were harassing me every day. They were threatening me. There was one list, the list of 72 or 76 intellectuals who are supposed to be executed. And it's enough to say that my name was on the first place. Very difficult to say that you can respond musically. Music, it is an abstract language which cannot say words. Music cannot say what we think, sometimes even if we think that we can. And it is the greatness of music. In a way, sometimes I was sorry because of that, because sometimes you want to send some particular message, and you want sometimes to say something, and that's this piano concerto, War Boogie. The title obviously indicated the war. It was written in the time when the war started. It was performed when the war started. It was performed at the so-called Bemus Festival in Belgrade, which was one of the best festivals in Europe at that time for years. I recalled one painting of Piet Mondrian, who during the Second World War did two paintings. One is Boogie, and the second one, War Boogie. So watching TV and seeing what happens around me, watching politicians, I told myself, my God, they really play some kind of demonic boogie. And it was the beginning of this boogie. I believe that this madness and everything what happened somehow can go, but I don't think that it can go so easily. It will take some time. Hatred will remain. Some problems will remain. And the people who participated in all of that, these people is the same. They cannot be changed just in 1 year. They somehow ruined the life of people who didn't want to participate in that. They ruined their own life. So what I could do, I did. So let us see what they'll do. I hope that in the future, economy is always, you know, stronger than many other things. So they live together, they are very close, they'll be neighbors. They have to trade, they have to travel. I hope that will be probably the main factor in the future.
Kalenovic teaches composition at Boston's Berklee School of Music. His latest piece, Sonata for War and Peace, premiered tonight as part of a week-long commemoration of the 10-year anniversary of the Siege of Sarajevo, called From Requiem to Renewal, a Decade of Balkan Conflict. For more information, check out our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.